Welcome to the Rearview Mirror Podcast, looking back on all that we don't know and a few things that we do. Are we on?
We are back for episode two on the Enneagram.
Back, hot mic, back, that's right, back. That's
right. How's your week been?
Chaotic. Mm. Yeah, so it's been okay though.
Yeah, work primarily?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Just, well, in light of our previous conversation, my week's been fun.
I'm sure it has been, yeah. Everything's fun. Wear how fun, me out, so dude. Fun. Drinking game. Fun, but nobody would last more than 10 minutes.
Oh, I could knock people out fast if, oh, that, was, kill it. If yeah. that was the word, yeah.
You'd kill it. You would absolutely kill it.
I'd like to think I could be more aware and mindful of that, but I'm not sure I will be.
I don't think it's anything bad.
No,
I
mean, it's just there all the time.
It's just a word. You just use that word a lot.
My favorite word, evidently.
But most sevens I know do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think we explained why on the last episode.
That's right.
So we dig into episode two of the Enneagram.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we talked about, I think, is we're doing this hoping to provide a lens that people can look at that would indicate this is something helpful and practical.
Yep.
And if you want to dive into the weeds on it, there are countless resources out there, but our goal is to try to make this understandable and practical, mm-hmm. so it's something that you can use.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's fun. I think what's, I'd say fun all the time.
You really do.
But I think back over our years of sitting around a table together and the number of times, I mean, I'm sure it's not every time we've been together, but the number of times that something about Enneagram stuff comes up, whether it was the two of us or the four of us or when we're together with couples, because it is, it's such a powerful tool for, as we said last time, for self-awareness, deeper understanding.
And I think this may have been in conversation. I don't think we did this on the podcast. But what I think you and I both love about it is it gives you language to describe mm-hmm. what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. instead of just saying, you know, oh, this person's exhausting. Why do they want to have fun all the time? It gives you language, or why am I a certain way?
Right.
It gives you language. Hey, this is God wired you this way.
Yeah.
And when you're healthy, it looks like this. And when you're not, it looks like this.
I can embrace and I can enjoy both me and others when I have a greater awareness that this person isn't out there just to, quote unquote, drive me crazy or something, you know?
Yeah.
Gosh, this is the expression of who they are.
So part two of the Enneagram, and I think the next, you know, if you were freshman, sophomore, junior, senior level, I think at the sophomore level, the next part is of the nine numbers.
Yeah.
They're grouped together in threes, mm-hmm. triads.
Yeah, exactly.
And in those three triads, there's a primary emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, within the three, there's a group that internalizes that emotion, mm-hmm. externalizes, mm-hmm. and then withdraws.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so,
it's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about that in a just kind of a basic way for a few minutes and kick that around.
Yeah, I'll give a real high overview of it. You did a perfect job setting it up. If we had the circle in front of us, again, if you've seen it, you can see it in your mind's eye. The nine sits at the top, and then it goes one, two, three, all the way around. If we put a dot right in the middle and we just drew three lines out, we would have the two, three, and four in one group, or triad, as you called them. And then we'd have the five, six, and seven. We'd draw a line between those, and they'd be in another little triangle called the second triad. And then the eight, nine, and then at the top, the one is our third triad. And again, it's just a way that we see how these three types in each triad have some similarities. Mm-hmm. Last week we talked about how incredibly different they are, but they also have some similarities. So, for example, we'll start with the two, three, and four. The two, three, and four is what we call the heart triad.
Okay.
The heart triad. They're always asking this question, who am I? The heart triad is about identity. It's just like, man, who am I? And it's this question of just going, how am I in my relationships? How am I connected with others? So you think about it, the two, three, and four look very different in relationships.
But, oh, man, yeah.
But they all do relationships. Remember we talked about the two, the helper, you know, they're always there to serve. The three, relationships can be somewhat utilitarian for the three because they're just grinding and cranking, getting stuff done. The four, highly relational, but it's going to come out and look very different than how a two's going to do it. But again, foundationally, that core emotion, and it makes sense, if the core question I'm asking in the two, three, four, in that triad, the heart triad, If the core question is, who am I? The core emotion, shame.
Yeah.
Shame. Like, okay, it's not only who am I, but how am I doing as who I am?
But if you're asking the question, who am I, then that indicates you have, there's something you think is missing from your identity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or wanting to make sure it's in,
make, or that's
make,
wrong yeah,
make
with
sure
you.
It's being presented well.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So again, there, you perfectly named what the shame looks like. You know, is it there and what's wrong with me? You know, what's not enough in me? But again, in the two, the three, and the four, the way that shame comes out looks very, very different.
So what does it look like for the two?
So for the Enneagram two, they're going to be the ones that generally, externalize, have to pause and
but
they're going to externalize it. So when their shame is present, that's when the two goes to their less resourceful side and they start feeling mopey, resentful, like nobody sees me. You can hear what's driven that. I didn't do enough. Oh my goodness. I love them so hard, but my love didn't save them. My love didn't help them enough.
Wasn't reciprocated.
Mm-hmm. So you'll hear it come out sideways. But again, that shame's motivating. Mm. The shame even can motivate them sometimes in their helping and in their serving, again, when they're not healthy, because it's now like, oh my gosh, have I done enough? Well, maybe I need to take another meal to them. Well, did I really let them know how much I appreciate them? You can hear how their behavior starts being externalized. They start going outward because shame is motivating if they're not careful.
So am I thinking, and I don't know the answer to this, so I'm really asking this question.
Yeah.
When you say externalize,
yeah,
does that mean...
Great question.
Is that the reaction that they're getting externally, or is this how they show it externally?
Second. It's kind of what's coming out of them.
Okay.
And again, it doesn't mean they walk around going, I feel shame, I feel shame. Probably not.
Right.
But you can see, and especially if you're two and you're aware that, okay, shame is one of the core emotions that I process. It's one of the core emotions that rises up in me. What's driving me to serve these people right now? Because if I'm externalizing my shame to go serve them, guess what? I'm going to resent them. But if what's driving me is, oh, I really love them, and man, they need a meal tonight, and I can help them out. Your resentment's probably not going to percolate up there because shame is in check at that point.
Right.
You're not doing something because you need to do it to be good enough. Mm. And shame's just insidious that way and how it eats our lunch, I feel like.
Mm. Okay, so what does it look like for the three?
So the three is going to ignore shame.
Okay.
You know, threes, it's like, again, we said this last episode, threes are the least emotionally aware of the nine types, generally speaking. Everything's a generalization when we talk about this, right? But threes often, they may express emotion in some way. They're usually unaware of what they're feeling. It's really hard for them to name it. Therefore, for shame, the core emotion for that three as well, they're just going to be like, well, you know, I'm aware of it. So that what do? They perform more. They drive more. That's why when you get to sit with a three who has failed at something, it's really a powerful, beautiful moment to be with them, because for the first time they're really feeling their shame, like, oh my gosh, but I've always been so good. I've been able to accomplish. Life always works for me. What happened? And part of the beauty of shame, as weird as this phrase may sound, is that shame can also be a gift that's telling us, well, I can't do everything. I have limits. And for the three, it's hard for that three part of me to admit that I have limits. You know, I should be able to do anything. But when I can slow down and realize, okay, I've been ignoring my shame, and so I keep trying to build this thing that I can't build. You know, I'm thinking of a website. When I tried to build a website once years ago, dumbest thing I ever tried to do, but I should be able to do it. Well, what was driving me? I should be able to. There's my shame speaking, and I ignored it. I didn't even see it. But when I can slow down and go, I don't think I know how to do this. That's really gracious for a three to do, and it's slapping shame in the face because it's saying, look, shame, I don't know how to do this. I need to hire somebody. I need to ask for help.
I was going to say, it's that old adage, you know, healthy shame lets you know that you need other people.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And threes are perfect for that, because if I don't know it's there, then I'm just keeping driving. But when I can be mindful of going, okay, where's my shame in play with me right now and how I'm trying to define myself?
Let me ask you a question on that. What's the difference between shame and regret?
Wow. This will be on our emotional intelligence podcast that we're going to do one day too.
Wow. That'll be a short one.
We'll bring in a couple
guests. Are those two separate terms, emotional and intelligence? Do you have to be emotional and intelligent?
Oxymorons,
yeah,
right?
Right. Holy cow.
Wait, what'd you say? The difference in shame and regret?
I don't know. What
did I say?
Shame. Yeah, what's the difference between shame and regret?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I think the shame is the emotional part of it. The regret is the cognitive part of it. But they don't always have to be the same. So for example, I could do something foolish this afternoon and suddenly have to deal with the consequence of it. Well, I probably regret that. Speeding. I mean, make it super easy. I do that frequently. But not in Franklin.
By frequently, you mean all the time?
Well, I'm a good driver. But, I get the speeding ticket. And while I'm getting the speeding ticket, there's probably some logical part of me going, dadgummit, I regret. I didn't need to be speeding. Why was I doing that? I was driving too fast. I deserve this ticket.
But you did something wrong and there's a consequence.
So now I regret that I got to write that $200 check.
Right.
Right. Shame is what it does to me then emotionally. Shame is the one that begins telling me this critical message, usually, especially toxic shame. It'll begin telling me, man, you're so stupid. You're not good enough. You're such a screw up. You do it wrong all the time. You deserve it. It's that beat up part. Shame tells me I'm defective. I often say it's the difference between shame and guilt is guilt is pretty logical. I either did something wrong or I didn't do something wrong.
Yeah.
You know? Shame, man, shame will trick you. Shame will trip you. That's why I call it insidious. Shame will just tell you, you know, you didn't just mess up. You are a mess up. Shame strikes at the identity. That's why it's connected to the question, who am
I?
The identity question.
Sure.
Shame is kicking the butts of the 2, 3, and 4 generally.
That's good.
And for the fours, and you can speak to this, fours generally, they internalize their shame, right?
For sure.
You know, we talked about it on the last episode again, when the four goes less resourceful, goes to that more unhealthy spot, and they move into that melancholy, that moody, they're beginning to shut down. They kind of disappear. Well, if you think about it, that's where shame's just having a heyday with them. It's telling them that message.
You're no good.
You're a screw up. Why'd you do this wrong? And they shut down.
And I play golf, which just enforces that. And we laugh about this and the guys I play with because we, you know, golf is such a unique game.
Yeah.
And you're out there by yourself. And when you hit a bad shot, everybody's looking at you. And there's no place to hide.
Right.
And you know you've hit it. And it just, and so typically you'll hear golfers say, you don't, the better players or the healthier players mentally will say, this is a bad shot. And you get to that point, then you get better. Most people would say, I'm an idiot. I suck. And it's just kind of a running joke that it exposes all of those.
Yeah. But isn't that true? I think it's such a great example. I mean, again, a little sidebar. I think it's such a great example that we have this expectation so often, especially probably in this heart triad, I should be able to accomplish anything. You know, and the reality is if you take me out to the golf course with you today, and if I respond like I did when I was trying to learn the game in my 30s, the first time I hit a shot off the tee, the ball's going to go super far to the right. You know, it will go further to the right than it goes straight.
Yes,
By far for me. And most of the time, I'll cuss. I'll throw a golf club. I can't believe that. So I'll do exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Instead of being able to go, I don't play this game. See, I'm so not good at it.
Yeah.
That's when my shame is in check, right?
Right.
I loved how you illustrated that.
It's, I play with a lot of guys, and this, you know, you could use an example at home, marriage, business, any example, but I think that base thought that I should be able to do this.
Yeah.
I'll play with guys, and there's this tendency, especially in golf, and, you know, I've seen it in other sports, where when you get closer to the hole and you're hitting, for example, a 100-yard shot, so you're closer, you're hitting a short club, and you should be able to hit the green, you know, and be able to putt. And I can't tell you the number of times I hear somebody say, man, I should be able to hit it on the green from 100 yards. But I think if you know the game and you play the game, mm-hmm. it's one of the hardest shots. Mm-hmm. And it's what the professional players are really good at.
Yeah.
But that should language comes into play. I should be able to put this back together. Yeah. I should be able to fix this. I should be able to build a website.
Yeah.
But recognizing, I don't know. Should I be able to? Yeah. Should I be able to do that?
Yeah.
I don't know. That doesn't sound like.
So if you think about,
if you told me 10 years ago you were going to try to build a website, I would probably say, well, why are you doing that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I probably needed somebody to ask me that question.
Yeah.
But again, in that three space, what we do is we just like, oh, there's something to do. It's on my to-do list. I'll go do it. I'll figure out how to do it. I can accomplish it.
Mm.
And the sad thing for the threes is a lot of times we're able to accomplish it. And then what that reinforces in us is, well, then I should be able to accomplish anything. Do you hear the shame growing?
And I don't need anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can get it done.
Yeah. So there's that wrong sense of autonomy. And there is that sense of, I should be able to accomplish this. So again, threes are ignoring it. Fours are internalizing it, just going to fill it. And that, again, leads to that melancholy. And the twos, if they're not careful, they will externalize it. And they'll come out usually looking like that, resentment, bitterness, you know, what self-pity almost.
Yeah, sometimes a reaction, I think, from the twos that I've seen this happen to is a disproportionate reaction to an event. And you're like, man, that felt like about a two on this conflict scale, and you reacted at about an eight.
Yes.
But it's been building.
Yeah. And again, that's the power of what's going on inside of us emotionally that we have to be aware of at some level. And I don't want to get too far down that road, but it really is important. And so for us for today, when we're thinking about this first triad we're talking about, shame is there. If you identify it primarily as an Enneagram 2, 3, or 4, you're battling shame at some level. And you're either keeping it more internal and it's shutting you down, you're externalizing it and you're living kind of, ooh, I hate this word, in that victim kind of space, or you're ignoring it, but people who love you, they see the battle.
Okay, in your opinion, this is impromptu, I haven't prepped you for this.
Good, I love this.
In your opinion, what's an antidote uh-huh. for shame?
Yeah. I say this all the time in my office with people. I think the only antidote for shame is truth speaking. Hmm. You know, shame. When Sarah was little, I remember she cut her finger, and it was so not even a cut, you know. But we had these brand new Beauty and the Beast Band-Aids. So she went and put one on. And I put it on. Laura was out of town at some event for the day. And so all day long, summer day, and she had it on, running around with it, playing in sandboxes, dirt. I didn't even think about it. And that night, I was lazy and Laura was out of town, so we didn't have bath time. The kid just went to bed, right? I'm efficient. I probably wanted to watch a movie. Next morning, got up, did the same routine, just, you know, played more and more and more. That night, I knew Laura was coming home, so it was bath time. And I remember putting Sarah in the bathtub, and she screamed bloody murder when she put her hand under the water. And I saw that Beauty and the Beast Band-Aid, and she pulled it off. And this little paper cut, basically, is what it was, because it had been covered up all day, and no telling how much sweat and dirt and junk had gotten in it in 30 hours. It was mildly infected, you know, just hydrogen peroxide kind of infected. But it hurt when it touched the water. And I remember I thought back on that so many times because that's the way shame is. When we do something that isn't good, when we make a mistake, we want to put the Band-Aid over so nobody can see it. But the problem is, in darkness, bacteria grows.
Yes.
And suddenly the shame metastasizes and it gets really big without us knowing it. Mm. Where the reality is, what I should have done that Friday when Sarah had cut her fingers, I said, oh, baby, you know, spit on it. You'll be okay. You know, you don't need anything. You're all right. Because healing requires sometimes open air. And I think that's the metaphor I think of often is that shame, it's imperative with shame that we're willing to go, hey, Steve, can I tell you about something that I did the other day? And especially when we can share it in a non-judgmental, loving environment, then go, yeah, Jeff, man, no, that wasn't good. But hey, it doesn't define you either. One of your classic lines.
I would say, too, that one of the things that's been helpful, and I've been in guys' groups, I've been in Bible studies, been in all kinds of things over the years, and all those things are great, and they all have their place, but for a man particularly, and for a woman, too, you know, I'd say, speaking as a man, particularly.
Glad to know that.
Yeah, right. It's really important to have a couple of guys, one guy, two guys. It doesn't happen as much in a bigger group is what I found. But you have to have somebody. I think you need someone. We all need someone that we can have that's a safe spot.
Yeah.
That you can say whatever.
Yeah.
And you could choose to say it or not, but telling the truth in a place or having a place that you can tell the truth is really important for a man.
So important. So I want to give a great example of how the Enneagram 3 works again. And it's because of what's going on in my brain as you're talking.
Do it.
When you were saying that, something, one word you said connected to me going, people are listening to this. You know, and so there's that image thing, right?
Yeah.
But this one didn't trigger image. This one triggered competence. So I'm going to turn around and look to make sure that I actually started recording this today.
Oh, this would be beautiful if you didn't.
I'm going to edit that out. No, I may not know. Okay, good. We're good. Okay, it is recording.
Dude, you can't make that up.
You can't make that up.
As I've said this before on this podcast, as our friend in this building says so often to me, God thinks that kind of stuff's funny. You know, and he says it in a more colorful way, and I'll try to be.
No, it's true. It's true.
Clean my mouth up for this.
I think if you're listening in and you know me, this is what my poor wife and this is what my dear friend Steve live with constantly with me is. It's that Enneagram 7 part of me that's, you know, whoop, there's a squirrel. Bird. You know, it's a squirrel. You know, I'm bouncing all around all the time, and that just happened. And had we not been recording, that would have been an awesome moment of efficiency for me, and no one would have known it. But since we were recording, everybody just saw me do that, and I feel great about it. Let's keep moving.
I don't have any problem with that.
I don't either.
We have recorded. We've done an episode that wasn't recorded on video. Not really any fault of yours.
Yeah,
but yeah, just something we didn't know what we didn't know.
Yeah, yeah, we're learning. Yeah.
Listen, we don't know anything about podcasts.
No, and it can trigger as the three part of me, the four part of you. It could trigger our shames, or we can just ask for help.
Yeah, that part doesn't trigger shame. That part doesn't trigger shame with me. Yeah. Plenty of other things do, but
not that one.
A guy told me one time that a counselor that I was talking to, and he said shame is hardwired into the four. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but I think it probably mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the one is unique with the inner critic.
Yeah,
constantly. Mm-hmm. I think the four particularly has to be aware of shame.
Yeah.
Because we go immediately. I won't speak for everyone. I go immediately to if I screw something up, yeah. Well, I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And sometimes I am. Mm-hmm. But it's not all the time.
I love what that counselor said. And it's almost like you know, I would say shame is hardwired into the Enneagram 4. In some ways, it's hardwired into the heart triad, the 2, 3, and 4.
Mm-hmm.
And in some way, it's hardwired into the heart, into the humanity, you know, because I think there is something about shame that all of us can identify with it. But I do think in Enneagram world, and especially the 4 internalizing it, that's why he says that, is it stays in you longer than it might in the 2. The 3 is going to give you a close run for your money because they're unaware of it.
So what comes to mind, and again, I don't want to get preachy, and if this is not what you believe, you know, that's between you and God.
Yeah.
If you look at and believe the story of the Bible and the Garden of Eden,
mm-hmm.
okay, Adam and Eve choose to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first thing they do when they're figured out?
Yeah.
They cover themselves. Mm-hmm. The shame. I mean, it's right. It's so early on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just it's a driving force.
Yeah. You think about Sarah's Band-Aid on the finger. Adam and Eve's fig leaf over themselves.
Right.
It's the same thing. We have to hide. Shame leads us into hiding, and there is life in hiding.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah.
Okay, next triad.
Okay, the next triad.
Let's go around the clock.
So we've gone 2, 3, 4. Now we go 5, 6, and 7. And again, when you think about the 5, you know, the wise, the investigator, you know, you think about the 7, you know, the playful, the fun, the enthusiast. It feels like there's no way they could share something similar, but they do. They're in the triad that we call the head triad. And so, you know, we start at the heart, you know, about my identity, shame, kind of the core emotion there. The head triad is asking a different question. Where am I? Now, obviously, this is not a geography question, but it is a question of where am I in life? Where am I in perspective or in proportion to something? And the 3 types may ask it a little differently, but their core emotion is going to be fear.
Okay.
And you think, I thought you were getting ready to ask
I was, I was, but I'm going to hold off on it. Okay, go ahead.
But if you think about it, even the way the fear looks different. For the 5, the fear is going to be, oh my gosh, do I know enough?
Mm.
You know? The 6, am I safe enough? The 7, oh my gosh, am I missing out on something? But right. All 3 of those are fear-based questions. You know, they come out of that place of fear. So fear is kind of that, again, it's that lingering emotion in the head triad. And for the people in that head triad, you know, they have a high need for reassurance. But again, it's reassurance about different things. For the 5, reassurance about my knowledge base, reassurance about my safety for the 6. And for the 7s, you know, FOMO, reassurance you're not missing out on anything, reassurance that there will be fun, reassurance we can do something that's going to be adventurous. But fear is still that emotion that's percolating foundationally in all three of those types. That's one of the things they share emotionally there.
So where I am is not necessarily, it's not, as you said, it's not geography.
Right.
It's where right. I am in relation to, I guess for the five, where am I in relation to my knowledge base with respect to mm-hmm. either at work, home, who I'm sharing that knowledge base with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for the six, it's where am I in relationship to the folks that I'm around or my core group or my people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the seven, where am I in terms of missing something?
Right. 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 Right.
Okay.
Am I being able to fully enjoy in that seven world? You know? Mm. So, you know, we talked about these, what were the three words we used that
internalize, externalize,
or
withdraw.
Ignore. So, yeah. So let's kind of think about the five, six, and seven that way for a second and see if I can remember these. The six externalizes,
yes.
right? I mean, that's easy to see, you know, oh my gosh, do we have enough? That's where the questions that we talked about last week come from. The five, they're going to internalize, their fear. So that's going to drive them to dig deeper, to study more, to turn over more knowledge. And the seven, similar to the three, they're going to ignore it. They're not going to be aware of it. I remember years ago, Laura asked Sarah, as a seven, you know, Sarah's our seven, said, they were having some conversation. I don't remember if Laura asked her, but Sarah made this statement. She goes, I'm not afraid of anything. And Laura goes, you're not afraid of anything? She goes, no, why be afraid? There's no reason to be afraid of anything. Everything's just an adventure. Everything's just fun. And Laura went into beautiful mom mode, and Laura was kind of like, okay, so Sarah, it's 1 a.m, you're downtown Nashville, are you going to walk down a dark alley? Well, I don't know, I might, it could be fun. We both look at them and say, what did you just say? And then, you know, Sarah's no dummy, but Sarah's going, oh, well, but that's not really fear. That's just, I just want to be wise. I just want to be smart. Well, there's a great correlation between fear and wisdom.
Sure.
The way I get wisdom is by acknowledging that there's something that could be dangerous, fearful. So, but for Sarah, her natural seven bent was, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm unaware that there's things that are good to be afraid of in life. Makes
right.
sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, healthy fear mm-hmm. can lead to a lot of things that are good.
Yeah.
Preparation, proper response, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah,
there's like anything. There's a certain amount of fear is okay.
Well, it's that wisdom word, right?
Yeah.
It really is that if I pay attention, fear is a wonderful gift to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I can find a wise way to navigate something. If I walk in this room this morning and there's 12 rattlesnakes rolling around on the floor, fear is not a bad thing to feel.
Yeah, and one of us will be, this podcast will be short-lived.
No, I'll never come in.
Yeah.
No, but that was a stupid example, but I think it kind of represents that fear doesn't have to be the problem. Fear is a natural reaction to a moment when I feel like, man, my safety is being threatened.
Right.
And so again, the five, six, and seven, back to our triads, the five, six, and sevens, they all share that. Again, am I internalizing, am I externalizing, or am I ignoring it?
Yeah. So... keeping a similar train of thought, antidote to fear?
That's a great question. You know, it's funny. That I'm hesitating because the first word that came to my mind is faith. And doesn't that sound just so like the church world? But yet I think that in some ways that's really a good word, is that there has to be some level of faith. And I don't mean just faith in God. There has to be some level, when I look at something I'm fearful of, some level of faith that says, oh wait, there's probably another option here. When I think about fear, one of the things that I know that we have to do when I'm aware that I'm afraid about something is I've got to have a plan to figure out well, then how to move forward in a different way. Mm. So my stupid example of you and I walking in the door, opening up and seeing rattlesnakes in the floor, goofy example. Well, fear is going to cause me to be wise and slam that door. So I've done something. I've moved to action. The worst thing that can happen with fear is when it paralyzes us.
Mm.
It's got to move us to action. And so when it moves me to action, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to pick up my phone and I'm probably going to call 911 because I don't know where the rattlesnake handlers live.
Yeah.
You know, the old Pentecostal friends back in my hometown. Maybe.
Right.
But you know, they're going to come over and they're going to call somebody from animal control and they're going to solve the problem. I'm not going to solve that problem, but my fear can motivate me. So I think a lot of the antidote to fear is a willingness to have a sense of confidence, a sense of faith, a sense of I can take a step forward right now. There's something I need to do to plan and prepare.
Yeah, I do think I like the prepared word that comes from that. There's a sense, you know, we talked about this a few weeks ago, if you keep digging down, there's a sense in which there's always going to be fear.
Absolutely.
And it always requires, whether you believe in God or not, believe the story of Christianity or not, there's an element of faith that this world requires.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
to get out of bed every day.
Right. And if you don't have that, then I don't think there's anything on the other side but despair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just think that, again, not to over church it, but
no.
There really is. There's a faith requirement, and faith doesn't mean that it's always going to work out right or the way you want it to, or work out the way we expect it to.
Yeah.
But
I remember years ago, Lloyd Ogilvy. He was a pastor of like Bel Air Prez or something out in something bougie out in California, but he also became the U.S. Senate chaplain for a season. And I remember reading a little thing he had written once, and he said that in the Bible, it says 366 times, do not be afraid. And I remember he went on in his article he wrote, and he was saying, it's not because God gets mad at us when we're afraid. He said, it's cute. He said, I think it's written 366 times because God knew we were going to live in a world that's so broken that every day we'd need to be reminded that we can be courageous every day, including leap years, 366 times. And I think it's true. And, it's interesting because in the Bible, when it talks about do not be afraid, it's not like God is ticked off about it. It's very invitational. And usually it's coupled with don't be afraid, I'm with you. Don't be afraid, I'll go before you. Don't be afraid, I'll carry you. Don't be afraid, I'll encourage you. And I think about when thunderstorms would come through when our kids were little and they would come running in the room in the middle of the night. I had two ways to say don't be afraid. One was don't be afraid, go back to your room. I suppose I could have done that. I'll never did that. I usually just lift the covers up. Hey, don't be afraid, baby. You can sleep here. Come here, big man. Sleep beside me. We're going to be all right. Don't be afraid. And I think to me, that's the antidote for fear is someone else sometimes speaking my life going, hang on, this isn't the end of the world. What do we need to do? How do we move forward?
Well, and I think just a sidebar on that. I love that story. And I was having this conversation with someone the other day. I think fear and anxiety and probably other topics that are talked about in the Bible, I think our tendency is to interpret those and say what you just said. If God says those are a prohibition, then I just shouldn't do them.
Right.
Flip that coin over. The reason they're in there so many times mm-hmm. is because we're going to experience those things all the time. Anxiety, fear, mm-hmm. money's talked mm-hmm. about a lot. Those are the core issues that we're going to battle with. Mm-hmm. And so when we battle with them, I think one of the things we can do pretty quickly is to say, wow, that just makes me normal and human.
Yes. And even,
and then, okay, then I'm going to think, all right, now I've lingered. How can I get some help and get out of this? I've lingered in it a long time. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I'm having fear or anxiety or I'm worried about money or other things that are talked about a lot, mm-hmm. in particular in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I just think we always viewed those mm-hmm. as something I've done wrong as opposed to just, man, God in his graciousness put that in there.
Yeah.
Because to your point, every day we're going to battle those things.
Yeah. I've always appreciated that. And I think that's what makes me, the older I get, makes my faith in some ways more simple, is that I see more and more is that it's not that I have a God who's demanding me to live perfect. It's just the opposite. I have a God who's so compassionate with going, dude, it's going to be really hard in that world.
And he's made provision for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that it for that triad?
I think.
Did we stop with that?
Yeah. We covered
pretty
three.
Good.
Yeah. I think so too.
Last triad?
Yep. 8, 9, and 1. We call that the gut triad, the instinctual triad, very intuitive and instinctual maybe is a better word. They're asking the question, how am I doing? How am I doing? Is an 8, as a 9, as a 1? And again, you can hear how that question is answered so different. 8, how am I doing? Am I accomplishing? Am I getting stuff done? Am I moving something forward, The 9, am I keeping peace? And, of course, the 1, they're asking that question, how am I doing it right? Am I doing it good enough?
Yeah.
Core emotion there is anger. Anger for these 3. And, again, it comes out in such different ways, just like we've said with all of them. For the Enneagram 8, that anger is often externalized. Now, I think, again, this is another one of those words that would be fun to play with. We think of anger as always a negative thing. Doesn't have to be. It's the most powerful force on the planet when used healthy.
Right.
So for the Enneagram 8, their anger can come out in a way that they're building the nonprofit that gives water to parts of the world that doesn't have clean water, right? Or it can come out as an anger that, in the less resourceful side, they look like the emotional bulldozer. It can come out either way. The Enneagram 9s, they're going to ignore their anger. Again, because anger might lead to conflict. Conflict will lead to the dissolution of peace. And the Enneagram 9, the peacemaker, they want to keep the peace at all costs, especially if they're on the unhealthy side of things. So they're going to internalize. I mean, they're going to be unaware. They're going to ignore. They're going to ignore their anger. Sorry. The Enneagram 1, then, they're going to internalize it. And that's where the ones, man, it's almost like that anger shame continuum, which makes sense because they're right beside the two, because they can internalize their anger, and that's where they beat themselves up. That's where they hold themselves to that standard of perfectionism that so often is completely unrealistic. But then they're just so, I can't believe I didn't do that well. You know,
I got a friend that I love having conversation with and at lunch that's an Enneagram 1, and we talk about the Enneagram, and he'll say, and I don't think he'd mind me sharing this, I won't share his name, but man, I always replay conversations in my head.
Yes.
To see if I should have said something differently or didn't say this. The irony is, and he's also, they're the group that comes to every meeting and sometimes not to this lunch, but I've got other Enneagram friends that when we go to lunch, they're going to bring business stuff like stacks of paper and files because they're going to work when I'm not there if I'm late or stay there and work. Yeah. So there's always information, but typically they don't use it or need it.
Right.
Because they're so much more well-prepared than they think.
Than they think they are.
Right. Yeah, but it's that inner critic going, hey, did I handle that conversation perfectly?
Well, again, I think what's fun about this triad, what's helpful for this triad to see, though, is the impact of their anger when they're unaware of it. You know, with shame and fear, we've talked about kind of the antidote. I think the same thing with anger, you know, again, as I said a minute ago, anger doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, but suppressed anger or overly expressed anger, inappropriately expressed anger, those can be really dangerous. But anger is that emotion that's inviting us to speak up, to speak for what we want or what we need. So you think about the 8, if they're less resourceful and it's coming out, their anger's coming out as the bulldozer and just driving over people and kind of not having a sense of people can't keep up with their pace, at some point the 8 needs to take a breath and go, wait a minute, what am I really needing right now? What do I want? What's going to help me? And be able to ask for the help with it, you know? I think for the Enneagram 1, the same thing. When they're beating themselves up so bad, when that anger is internalized, when they're giving those messages that they teeter-totter between anger and shame in those moments, I think for the 1 to be able just to go, hey, I don't know how to do this very well right now, or I do need help, or wait, it doesn't have to be perfect, or the hardest thing for 1, this is good enough. You know, when they can get to that place, again, it will help subside some of that anger. And then for the 9, you know, we say this about the 9s all the time. We've talked before and said that the 9s have a tendency to fall asleep to themselves, to numb out. So when the anger is, when the 9 is ignoring their anger, that's exactly what's happening. They're numbing out. And so I tell the 9s all the time, hey, this might be a good time to wake up, to wake up to yourself and be aware, is there something you're angry about? And usually, oh no, I'm not angry. Ignore it. Well, let me ask you a different question. Is there something you really want right now that you're not able to get? And most 9s can go with that because their want is going to, they think if it's met, will lead them toward peace. Well, that's another way of just saying, what are you angry for? What do you really want here?
Right. And if you've ever seen a 9 that's held it in and then get mad.
Ooh, baby.
Yeah. Look out.
They got power.
It's in there.
It is in there.
When you said that a minute ago, I was thinking about this verse that I ran across about the 8s and the water. You know, if there's a water problem in another country, how can we fix it? The Lord gives righteousness and justice to those who are treated unfairly.
Mm.
And I think, man, that resonates with the, that resonates with the 8s, and I see it in my 8 friends.
Yeah.
They are way more compassionate than I am for the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the ability and usually the competence to do something about it.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the takeaways today is that didn't really think about this before, but man, there's so much good to each personality type when they're healthy.
Yes.
And encouragement both to try to, you know, first to try to, you know, be as healthy as we can, but also to notice it in others and, you know, encourage that tag along on the coattails a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's, it was one guy that wrote about the Enneagram years ago talked about how, you know, again, the little circle with the hole in the middle, he talks about how that the nine types that work around that hole in the middle, they all reflect nine different attributes, nine different characteristics of God. And if you know, you walk through them, you think about it, you know, God is a reformer. He is good. God is a helper. He is loving. God is efficient. He gets stuff done.
Yeah.
God is individual. He is creative. And we can walk all the way around them. And so, you know, again, the beauty of owning our preferred type is that we get to go, man, and when I let the world see this part of me, this is a small way I get to reflect the goodness of who God is.
And it's the opposite of hiding.
Exactly. Which takes you back to what you talked about 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So there's freedom in saying, man, I really want people to see the fullness of who I am. But again, I think one of the biggest...
That's a scary thought.
Well, there is. I was going to say, I think one of the biggest reasons we don't do it is the comparison game. And in the comparison game, I've valued. So, okay, wow, the way Steve does that is better than the way I do that. Then I need to do it like Steve. Okay, so... especially the three part of me, the chameleon in me, man, I'll start doing it like Steve, but I'm not being true to who I am. Instead of being able to go, Steve, I think it's so cool when you do that, but you know what? This is what I would do in that situation. And my way's not better than yours, but it may very well be different.
It's true to you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the way God made you.
And you know, you think about it, gosh, you know, if you had all nine types roll up to a crisis situation, they would be very different how they responded. But at the end of the day, if all nine of them were truly authentic with who they are and did what comes natural to them in their healthy spaces, those types, whatever the crisis was would probably be addressed really well, because you'd have those that's taking care of the patient, making sure the patient's okay in the crisis. You'd have those that are getting the additional resources brought. You'd have others who are lifting the tree off the top of the car. But we would all be doing, man, this is what I am. And again, the beauty of the Enneagram is that when we value not only our strength, but we value the strength, albeit entirely different in how it looks, of those around us.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So I think these triads are helpful. If you're listening in, you know a lot about the Enneagram. You know, you also are going, well, gosh, there's other sets of triads. There's other sets of three things. And, you know, someday, we're not planning to do it now, but someday maybe we can talk some about those as well, because some of you may know the phrase stance work. And if you do, there's something really cool about that as well. It's another way of just seeing how there's similarities between different types while still staying in my, boy, this is my foundational space. So I just say that because there's, you know, when we talk about how robust the Enneagram is, you use that word at the beginning of the last podcast, it's so true. You know, there's a way that we can look at the Enneagram. We talk about nine types. There's a way that we can look at the Enneagram when we think about what we're doing today, the triads or this stance thing that I'm referring to, or when we think about these different ways that we categorize each of our types. And the reality is there can be up to 81 different types on the Enneagram. There can be these subtypes within the types, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's so many ways to nuance us. So again, I think I say this at the end of our two episodes on the Enneagram to say, be careful not to try to turn this into the little box that defines you or defines anyone else. And use it. Take advantage of it. Study it. Read about it. You know, there's great articles online, because it really will bring greater insight and awareness, not just to you, but again, to the people that you live, love, work, and play with. That's the beauty of this tool, I think.
Well said.
Yeah.
All right. Until next time.
We'll be back.
It will not be an Enneagram episode next time. That's two. So we're going to stop there. Move on to something else.
You know, that sounded like the wrap, but I'm going to ask you one last question.
I did that to you last time. You wrapped it and I asked you a question. Now you're just getting me back.
Yeah. No, but this is fun. I thought this earlier.
Okay.
You know, we call this thing the Rearview Mirror Podcast. We're looking back. And you've kind of touched this a couple times today, but let me just ask it in one question as a good wrap up question. If 25 years ago, Steve, 30 years ago, Steve, had been introduced to the Enneagram, and you understand your, you understood your type like you do today, and you understood Jen's type. I'll use your, pick on your marriage. I can pick on your work, but I know your wife, so I'm going to use that for example right now. And you understood Jen's type like you do today. How would that have changed the course of that relationship?
I'm divided on that.
Cool.
Because you and I have talked about this a lot. The practical, I think, easy answer is, man, if I would have known that, we would have had a more peaceful marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
Or more. But the reality is, I'm not sure how receptive I was 30 years ago.
That's fair.
I'm not sure how receptive she was 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you go back, again, I think we said this, the assumption is if I'd have made a different decision going back, the road would be smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, at this age, I don't necessarily think that's true.
Yeah.
So, yes, in one sense, I would have liked to have known.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Enneagram would have given us language where, in theory, I would have been more, I would have probably shown more grace to her personality.
Mm-hmm.
She may have shown more grace to mine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The reality, you're so full of, you know, spunk and, you know, life mm-hmm. in your 20s and 30s. I'm not sure how much you're listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or not, I shouldn't say you're, because I don't put that on everybody else, how much I was listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, great question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that it would have been any different. I think I love, you know, because of my kids and work stuff, I hang out with a ton of younger people.
Yeah.
You know, play golf with some the other day. One of the things I love is their dogma.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're so freaking dogmatic about everything. They're so sure. They're certain, as my dad used to say, often wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah.
And I've lost a lot of that.
Yeah.
And so when you ask that question, I think, man, I just don't know that I would have been receptive to it, even if I would have known it.
Yeah. Yeah.
At that age.
That's a great Enneagram 4 answer to that question. Thank you. All right.
What would you think? I mean, would you answer it differently?
I think what I'm seeing in my office, I think I'm seeing even in my kids, and I, again, it's so unfair to project me onto them. I was pigheadedly stubborn, so who knows? Like you, it may not have done anything for me. But I guess the way I'm thinking about the question is, the earlier I think we're exposed to any tool that helps us see ourselves more clearly, the higher the likelihood of having healthier relationship or connection with
gives you a chance.
I think a better chance is all
increases the odds. Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
I just think Laura and I had fights that were just so stupid because I couldn't appreciate that. Gosh, you know, I wish I could maybe say, oh, she's a 9 right now. And so, wow, she's just shutting down because this doesn't feel peaceful to her. She needs some space. But instead, I'd be like, no, we're staying up tonight. We've got to resolve this. So I think that's the
way I'm
thinking about it, is that, you know, if you're in your 30s, 40s, you're listening in and you've never been around a tool like this, when I peek back through the rearview mirror, I go, yeah, I think it might have helped us navigate some of the crap that was inevitable that we had to navigate with perhaps just a skosh more compassion. You know, I guess that's how I'm thinking about it. But I love what you're saying in that part of the first half of life is that I don't need anything. I can drive. I can push. I can keep moving. I can go. That motor is beautiful. I honor it. I respect it. But I think that motor can be actually accentuated with a deeper understanding of, wait, okay, so what's going on inside of me when my motor is running so hot and so high?
You know, and the tool is just a tool.
That's all it is.
You have to be willing to accept it. And so when I say that, I agree with you. It certainly would not have hurt.
Yeah.
Probably would have helped some.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, I don't know the answer to this. I just wonder if I'd be more.
Yeah. Who knows?
Receptive to things. Probably so.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely would have helped. Yeah.
So when you said that, what was the line you said to me when we were first talking about this podcast?
Oh man, there's no telling.
Oh no, it's great.
Be careful that you don't repeat something I wouldn't want you to.
No. This is perfect. Because what you just said that was so good is you said, you know, the Enneagram is just a tool, but I don't know if I would have used it. And you had some line about, I have a toolbox filled with tools that I don't know how to use. Was that your line?
Probably a different episode. Yeah, I realized the other day. So in my stress, I guess we're not ending this podcast. We're still going. Yeah. In my stress, I like to clean things out.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's
and
right.
I can be OCD about stuff. You know, the kitchen and the garage are the two things. You know, that's my little space. And so I go out and I start. It's kind of a nice day in the middle of gloomy winter, and I'm going to clean out everything in the garage. It's been needing it for a while. And I decide I go over there to my little toolbox area. I have a toolbox. Why I have a toolbox, I have no idea. Because when I tell you that the number of tools in there, the ratio of tools in that toolbox versus tools I know how to use is so minute that it probably doesn't even register. But yeah, I realize I had four or five of some things I couldn't even identify. And sorry to say, I threw a lot of them away. If I don't know how to use it, I for sure I don't need four.
Yeah.
You know, one maybe. And yeah. There's hardly anything in it anymore.
That's right.
Because that's really all I know how to use. I just don't know how to. I don't know how to use a lot of tools in the toolbox, but it was interesting that we talked about that the day before we talked about the podcast, because the tools in the toolbox,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and that's, again, maybe this will be the wrap this time, but I love what you said. This is a great, great tool. And like any tool, it takes time to learn it. It takes practice to learn it. But I do believe that it can be really useful in, again, self-awareness, connecting with others. So, I agree. Those of you listening in, I hope you'll dabble with it more if you're new to it, because it will be valuable for you.
I would encourage you to do the same. It's been a fun thing in a lot of aspects.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Wrap it up.
We'll talk soon.
All right. See you.